record twice, like I've done this before. So just as you kind of think through that. Okay, in the north, the kings are all, they're from a variety of different places. Some are kings, some are military commanders, some are coups that take over. They're random and interesting, okay? I color-coded the kings for you so you can get an idea, okay? Black meaning these are wicked kings with a black evil heart, okay? So in the north, you'll notice there are 19 kings, and there are not any godly kings, okay? There are some that will have maybe a hint of godliness, but in the end, they're all evil, okay? The northern reign, as you look all the way at the bottom underneath Hoshea, he's going to be the king on the throne in Israel when Assyria comes in 721 BC and destroys the northern kingdom, okay? We'll see that recorded in 2 Kings chapter 17 as these kings kind of get lined out, okay? So that's going to be the end. The southern kingdom of Judah will continue to go on for another 100 plus years until 586 BC when they are destroyed, when the temple that Solomon built is destroyed by the Babylonians when they come in, okay? So Assyria comes in. They're going to deport everybody to Assyria. They are horrible. They are the worst nation in the world that you want deporting you and controlling you. They are awful, okay? So they behead people. They make a mockery of the people that they come in and take over. It's a bad, bad deal for the Jews that are up north, okay? Babylon is better, but not great. They kind of take the blue chips and they assimilate them into their society. They take the best of someone else's culture and they just kind of re-assimilate them into their culture. Teach them arts, teach them history, and they try to make them Babylonian and basically weed out anything that is Jewish. So as you guys think about Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, those were all guys that the blue chips of Israel that got pulled into Babylon and were taught and raised in that system, and yet still in the midst of it, were able to cling to a sense of godliness and to their God and in the practices thereof, okay? So that's a bit of the differences, okay? So Assyria is going to be the one that takes the northern kingdom, 722 BC. I remember that date. And then Babylon's going to come in and take the south in 586 BC, destroy the temple, the people, Jerusalem, the wall, the whole kit and caboodle. It all goes down, okay? This, by the way, was predicted by God to Moses. As you guys remember, when they went into the land, Moses is about to die, and God whispers in his ear and says, hey, I know it's going to happen. I'm going to bring these people in. I'm going to give them the land that I promised, but they're going to disobey, and I'm going to kick them out of the land. This is coming. So this isn't a surprise to God, and he does it on purpose. Okay, so as you guys look at that, all right? Next to each king, you'll see a number, like how long they reign. So you'll see, you know, like Jeroboam the first is 22 years. You look a couple further down, you got Zimri, who reigned for a week. Okay, there's a guy, I think, that reigns for 2 days. Where is he? 2 years, 3 months. No, maybe that's it. Okay, Zimri's a military guy that basically, 1 month, there he is. Shalom. Okay, you've all heard of him, right? He's probably your favorite king ever. I couldn't tell you one thing about that guy. Not one. Okay, he reigns for a month. So you'll see kind of different, the way kind of all this falls out, okay? So you'll get, if it goes from blue to black, it's a king that started well and then ended horribly, and then you got one king. Where is he? Manasseh, who reigned 55 years. He's about three quarters of the way down on your left-hand side underneath Judah, who starts black and goes blue, okay? And he's going to be one of those guys you wish didn't, okay? This is like a Ted Bundy conversion where you're like, oh, really? Like, this guy decided to put his faith in the Lord. You go, yeah, God's even gracious to those. So Manasseh was probably one of the most wicked kings. But at the end of his life, man, converts, okay? So there are gold mines of treasure within these guys. Their stories are absolutely amazing. We don't have time to roll through all 39 kings in detail, so I will skip rocks through portions of 2 Kings and kind of get to the important stuff, but I want you to be able to see is the big picture of this and how they flow, okay? So if, for example, I was giving you a test on these, I would want to know key dates. I would want to know how many kings reigned on each side. I would want to know big picture stuff, okay? I don't want you to tell me how long Pekah reigned. I don't care, okay? It's not important. But you want to know the big picture important stuff, okay? So the kingdom splits in 931. That's important. Assyria comes in 722 and takes the northern kingdom. That's important. Babylon comes in, takes the southern kingdom of Judah in 586 and destroys the temple. That's important, okay? I would know probably some key kings like Rehoboam, Solomon's son, in the south. Jeroboam, the first king. So those are important. You'll notice in here as well, in kind of that orangish color. I'm sure some woman has another box of crayons that has a different color in there than I do. But in my 8 box, that's called orange. You'll see the reigning superpower at the time, kind of the enemies of Israel. It's going to start with Egypt. They're going to be the superpower on the block. And then Aram or Syria. We'll see several of their kings mentioned throughout the journey. Then to Assyria, who's the reigning power, back to Egypt, then Babylon, and then ultimately it's going to go to Persia, who is the superpower on the block when Nehemiah, Ezra, and Zerubbabel come back. Okay, so Cyrus, king of Persia, is the guy that's going to give the green light for the Jews ultimately to return after captivity. You guys remember, they're in captivity for 70 years as a punishment. And we'll see it mentioned in here. We'll see kind of why that happens. Part of it's a heart issue. Part of it is their lack of obedience to the sabbatical year, as Jeremiah tells us about. And then ultimately they are given the green light from God after that punishment to go back in. And one of the things that is beautiful about this, when they return to the land underneath Nehemiah and Ezra and Zerubbabel, we never again see idolatry in the land. So God weeded out of them what he was trying to weed out from the beginning, which was any worship of other false gods. Okay? So does this make sense? You guys got a bit of a handle on this? Any questions about that big picture? Janelle's like, no. Can you read it? Does it make sense? Is there any confusion? I've gone through about 19 times to try to fix all my misspellings and whatever. So I tried to give you a synopsis, by the way, of each king from the text, so you guys have a little bit on them. All of the southern kings, by the way, 2 Chronicles covers all those. 2 Chronicles is a view of 1 and 2 Kings, but just from the tribes of Judah. Okay, they don't care about the northern kings. Ezra, who wrote it, doesn't, because they're not necessarily part of the line. But the southern kings, you get like and also in 2 Chronicles. And usually it's a behind-the-scenes director's cut of a movie, okay? It's additional information to each one of these kings that's helpful and really cool. In fact, we'll go there in a couple of the kings this morning as you see them, okay? So that's the big picture layout, all right? That is all of the Old Testament history, by the way, that we have left. And then it ends, okay, with Ezra and Nehemiah coming back into the land. That's the rest of your Bible that we haven't studied, okay? Everything else, prophets, minor prophets, all fit within this chart, okay, in terms of when they ministered, okay? Couple guys that I didn't mention, by the way, you see in the middle, Elijah and Elisha, the purpley pink color. Those are the prophets that God's going to call to rebuke Israel, specifically Ahab. Elijah's going to be the prophet that's going to work on Ahab. Ahab is probably, I think I said it, the most wicked king up to his day, and certainly is going to stand out in the top three ever of wicked kings. And then his successor, Elijah's successor, will be Elisha. And he will minister to the northern kings as well and try to get them to convert. And obviously you can tell how well they did. None of them converted. They're all wicked, okay? But they tried real hard, okay? Yes, sir.
Where does Jeremiah sit in all of these goodies over here?
Jeremiah is going to be towards the end of the southern kingdom. He's going to minister during the time of Isaiah. He's going to be in the time of Hezekiah and Josiah. Okay, so if you look down there, those guys are kind of reigning during that time, and those are the prophets that are speaking to that. So, Isaiah and Jeremiah will be in that time period towards that latter part. Okay.
Do you know which king of Judah correlates with the fall of Israel off the top of your head?
Yes, Hezekiah is the reigning king. He's going to watch the fall of the north. Okay, you'll see that. Okay, fascinating story, by the way. Okay, what he does and kind of how he watches that go down. Okay, God's going to show up in a major way. Assyria comes within a hair's width of destroying the southern kingdom as well when they come in and destroy the north. And God shows up in a miraculous way and saves their bacon. And it's fascinating. And Hezekiah kind of blows it, to be honest with you. So he's got a fascinating story. We'll look at that, okay? So yeah, Hezekiah is the guy that's reigning in the south in Judah when the northern kingdom gets destroyed. And literally he's got seats on the 50-yard line to watch the whole thing go down. and sees what's coming for his own kingdom, like the handwriting's on the wall for Judah as well, and doesn't handle it real well. Okay? Great question. So unfortunately, the way they line up, they're not like, just look straight across and find the current king and whatever. My paper's not big enough. And when you got a guy who reigns for, 2 years, and a guy who reigns like Manasseh for 55 years, we would have a really long sheet of paper. Okay, so at least you guys have an idea. Cool? All right, so keep that handy. Okay, you're just going to want it to reference. We got a lot of names, so I'll point back to the chart frequently so you guys just have your bearings, because without it, it gets a little convoluted. So we'll go from there. Okay, so we're in the life of Solomon. We haven't seen the kingdom split yet. Okay, we watched his rise to fame. We saw some incredible qualities of this guy. We saw the stuff that he did, mainly the building of the temple, right, and the sacrifices and all that went into it. We saw in chapter 8 kind of the finality of that, the idea that, man, they offered to God great things. God shows up. I mentioned 863, the amount of sheep that they offered. 120,000 sheep. I was out riding my bike last week on Watts Valley Road, and there was a bunch of sheep out there. There were probably 200. And I thought, what do you think 120,000 sheep would have looked like? Dead sheep, sacrificed sheep on an altar. I mean, I don't think you could fit those in a sanctuary. I mean, not to be grotesque, but the idea behind giving God your first and your best, and Solomon went above and beyond. This guy starts in an amazing way, and you guys see his humility. You see him ask for the right things. He prays for wisdom. God says, man, I'm going to give you wisdom in spades, and because you didn't ask for riches, because you didn't ask for the wrong things, I'm going to bless you with money. I'm going to bless you with that as well, okay? And Stephen, you asked a great question last week in regards to why does God continue to bless Solomon knowing that he's going to crater? Is it not the fault of God? Because he gave him too much money, he gave him too much success, he let him have too many women, whatever it may be. And we're going to see this morning what caused Solomon's downfall, okay? And I tend to point at Solomon and not God, okay? So just as you're kind of looking at that, all right? So we finished in chapter 8, yes? Picking up 9 verse 1. Does that sound familiar? Hopefully. Yeah? Más o menos? I think. If we didn't finish 8, 8 is the dedication of the temple. It's one gigantic ceremony of them finishing the temple. Okay, so it's Solomon's prayer. I shouldn't say it's just anything. It's fantastic. But it's the dedication of the temple. All the pieces come together. 8 verse 11, God shows up. You guys remember the priest could not even be in the area because God shows up, the Shekinah glory of God. Solomon prays just, again, as a review, hey, God, minister to us. When we blow it, show up. Let us confess to you in this place. Make this place work like the tabernacle worked. And God says, okay, we can do that. So it all works. It looks like it's going to be great. This wasn't necessarily, I think, God's first, but God's like, okay, you want a king? I'll give you a king. And if the king obeys me, we can make the system work. If that king will walk with me, this can work. If that king disobeys me, it won't work. And that's exactly what we're going to see with the temple. The temple could have worked, but the temple's going to go sideways. And God says, listen, if that's what you want, then I will bring in a pagan nation and they'll come destroy the whole thing. I don't care about this building. I don't care about the gold. I don't care about how ornate it is. That is not what's important to me. Okay? Now, before we get to Solomon's downfall, we're going to see more of his press releases, I guess, if you will, more of his front page paper debuts. 9 verse 1, let's pick up there.
As soon as Solomon had finished building the house of the Lord and the king's house and all that Solomon desired to build, the Lord appeared to Solomon a second time, as he had appeared to him at Gibeon. The Lord said to him, I have heard your prayer and your plea, which you have made before me. I have consecrated this house that you have built by putting my name there forever. My eyes and my heart will be there for all time. All
right, so how does God respond to this whole thing in chapter 8? In the building of it that's now taken 20 years.
He's there.
Yeah, he's there. This will work, Solomon. No problem. If, keep going.
And as for you, if you will walk before me as David your father walked, with integrity of heart and uprightness, doing according to all that I've commanded you, and keeping my statutes and my rules, then I will establish your royal throne over Israel forever, as I promised David your father, saying, you shall not lack a man on the throne of Israel.
All right, so what's the promise to Solomon? What is this referring to, by the way, as I promised your father David? What specific event are we discussing here?
David's line.
Yeah, the Davidic line, 2 Samuel 7, the Davidic covenant, okay? Very important. I would know that, okay? So God's referring back to, hey, I promised David he would have someone on the throne forever. Now, Solomon, we can continue that through you, and we can make that line continue through your sons if you'll obey me. If not, I'm going to honor my word to David, but there can still be calamity coming if you're not going to obey, and I will accomplish my will and my work if you are not going to do that, regardless, okay? But he says in verse 6, if your sons indeed turn away from following me, shall not keep my commandments and my statutes, which I have set before you, shall go and serve other gods and worship them. Man, in verse 7, I'm going to cut them off. I'll cut off Israel from the land which I have given them, the house which I have consecrated for my name. I will cast out of my sight, so that Israel will become a proverb, a byword among all the peoples. Israel's story will be like a saying amongst the pagan nations. It'll be a story told around campfires at night by the Egyptian, the Arameans. It's going to be so bad that it'll be discussed in the history to come because of what God will do if Israel chooses to disobey.
You said chapter 7 of first or 2 Samuel?
2 Samuel. 2 Samuel 7. Okay? So, Davidic covenant. Okay? Verse 8, I think we touched on this. This house will become a heap of ruins. Everyone who passes by will be astonished and hiss and say, why has the Lord done this to this land and to this house? God's not afraid, right? He doesn't care about the stuff. What's more important, again, are the hearts of the people, and specifically the heart of Solomon, okay, and how he walks with God during this tenure. Now, Solomon's been walking with God at this point and been king for 20-plus years, 25, let's see, 6 years into it. So, yeah, he's 26 years into his reign or so. He's pushing 50 at this point, close to that, okay? So he's onward and upward, okay? We talked about the end of this in chapter 9, that Hiram, king of Tyre, the guy that supplied all the timber to Solomon, Solomon tries to pay, but he's depleted his bank account, so he gave him a bunch of the cities up in the north. You guys remember that? In the Galilee, Hiram kind of went like, these are garbage cities. Why did you give these to me? So why Solomon gave them away, we don't know, but probably because he had depleted his bank accounts, and that's all he had to pay with. Okay, verse 16 of chapter 9, Pharaoh, who's king of Egypt, these guys are buddies right now, okay, this won't last long in terms of Egypt and Israel's relationship, but for the time being, remember Solomon had married Pharaoh's daughter, he captures Gezer, burns it with fire, kills the Canaanites who live there, and then gave it as a dowry for Solomon's wife. So Solomon has given Gezer, the city, one of the gateway cities. Solomon, in verse 17, wisely rebuilds it, makes it a gateway city, fortifies it as a city to the west of Jerusalem so that it is a bunker of protection against any attack coming from the west ultimately into Jerusalem, okay? Let's see. Rest of 22, I think we mentioned all of this in chapter 9. Solomon does not make slaves, verse 22, of the sons of Israel. He puts the forced labor to work from the other inhabitants of the land that had come in. Doesn't put Israel to forced labor just yet, but will ultimately. And then in 26 and following, we mentioned that Solomon had started a navy. This is the first time we've ever seen that. And these guys go out and get a grip of gold. I think we mentioned verse 28, the amount, 428 talents of gold from there, which is 15.75 tons of gold. Okay, one of the things that Solomon is going to cause in the land is hyperinflation because they have so much money. The price of everything skyrockets, okay? It even says at some point in the text that silver was useless in Solomon's day and age because they had so much money, okay? That's not necessarily a good thing, right? Hyperinflation is bad, but Solomon had so much wealth and everyone else had so much abundance that it ultimately causes a problem, okay? Now, in chapter 10, because his fame is spreading and because he's becoming a big deal, he gets a visit, 10 verse 1, okay, from the Queen of Sheba. Read that.
Now when the Queen of Sheba heard of the fame of Solomon concerning the name of the Lord, she came to test him with hard questions. She came to Jerusalem with a very great retinue,
sure,
with camels bearing spices and very much gold and precious stones. And when she came to Solomon, she told him all that was on her mind. All
right, so she's kind of a big deal. She's the queen of the Sabaeans, probably. And she comes with questions. And Solomon, in verse 3, doesn't politic her. Watch what he does.
And Solomon answered all her questions. There was nothing hidden from the king that he could not explain to her.
So she gives him the hardest stuff that she's got to deal with as a queen in her land. Solomon answers, according to his wisdom, all of them. And she's so impressed by Solomon. This is what she does.
And when the Queen of Sheba the wisdom of Solomon, the house that he had built, the food of his table, the seating of his officials, and the attendance of his servants, their clothing, his cupbearers, and his burnt offerings that he offered at the house of the Lord, there was no more breath in her.
Keep going in six.
And she said to the king, the report was true that I heard in my own land of your words and of your wisdom. But I did not believe the reports until I came, and my own eyes had seen it. And behold, the half was not told me. Your wisdom and prosperity surpassed the report that I had heard.
You guys remember the story of Paul Bunyan and the ox? Did you guys ever hear that one growing up? It's the old wise tale. This, you know, Paul Bunyan is this guy with an axe and an ox, and like slower, and is the story gets told over and over and over. Paul Bunyan gets bigger, the ox gets bigger, everything gets bigger. Now he's a giant, right? But in reality, he's just a dude. Solomon's the exact opposite of that. His fame is gigantic, and they tell him as if he's a giant, and then people come to see him and realize that's not even the half of it. Like, the Queen of Sheba had this, like, unbelievable opinion of Solomon that had been communicated to her of how wise and how much money, and then she gets there and realizes, oh, gosh, like, I thought that was a farce, but it's even beyond what I was told about you. Like, his fame, his wealth, his wisdom is off the charts. She doesn't even have a way to measure it at this point, so... what Solomon has done in a 25, 30-year tenure as king is absolutely insane. So he is blessed. And she says in verse 8, how blessed are your men, how blessed are these your servants who stand before you and before you continually and hear your wisdom. Blessed be the Lord your God, who delighted in you to set you on the throne of Israel, because the Lord loved Israel forever. Therefore he made you king to do justice and righteousness. I mean, this guy's having like a near conversion, watching Solomon reign, his wisdom, his godliness. At this point in Solomon's career, what is underneath the surface is still solid enough to sustain what's above the surface. He hasn't cracked yet, and she's looking at this saying, holy cow. Like, she's converted in a sense by what she sees, okay? Blessed are your be your God, verse 9, who delighted in you. She talks about, again, this, who made you king. And again, the purpose of that, to be righteous and to do justice. In verse 10, as a thank you, this is what she does.
Then she gave the king 120 talents of gold and a very great quantity of spices and precious stones.
Okay, 4.5 tons of gold. A Honda Civic weighs a ton. Okay, so... that's a lot of gold, right? I don't know what I would do with a tenth of that, but apparently Solomon had need of it. Now, just begin to keep this in mind. You guys are seeing that you should have Deuteronomy 17 in the back of your mind on that back burner, thinking, man, I think he's got probably some money. At some point, we have surpassed not acquiring too much gold, too much women, too much whatever. Solomon is quickly exceeding his limits in every one of these areas. So I don't know where that line is, but... I would assume 4 tons of gold is plenty. A lot of horses, right? A lot of wives. He's up there, okay? Keep going.
Moreover, the fleet of Hiram, which brought gold from Ophir, brought to Ophir a very great amount of almug wood and precious stones.
Okay, Ophir was the place we just talked about with Solomon's navy that's rolling down the Gulf of Eilat, out south out of Israel, and picking up more and more gold. That brought in 20 talents of gold, or to the 15 and a half tons-ish of gold. So he's continuing all the time to find gold, to find resources, and he's getting stupid rich in the midst of this, okay? Keep going.
And the king made of the almug wood supports for the house of the Lord and for the king's house, also lyres and harps for the singers. No such almug wood has come or been seen to this day. And King Solomon gave to the Queen of Sheba all that she desired, whatever she asked besides what was given her by the bounty of King Solomon. So she turned and went back to her own land with her servant.
All right, so we're seeing just this continual idea of Solomon's abundant blessing. Now, in verse 14, I want you to think like a Hebrew for a second, like a Jew, okay? Now, the weight of gold which came to Solomon in 1 year was 666 talents of gold. Now, as an American, what is the first question you ask me? How much is that? It doesn't matter, okay? That's what Americans ask. Hebrews would ask, why did God write 666 talents of gold? Okay? And the answer to that is why?
Evil.
It's evil. It's a sign. It's saying something. They don't want to know how many tons. They don't want to know In today's economy, how many Ferraris does that buy me? It doesn't matter, okay? The idea is it's a grip, and it's an evil number. There's a reason he didn't say 665 or 667. It's saying something about the amount of wealth that Solomon has. It's too much. It's unsustainable. No man can handle that much wealth without becoming evil. It's a problem. Money isn't the issue, right? What's the issue? The heart. Solomon can't sustain that. And frankly, who could, right? He has, and by the way, in case you want to know, that's 25 Honda Civics of gold, okay? A year. A year. That's what his paycheck was. That is insane. It's just beyond measure. Again, hyperinflation, it just doesn't make sense to even try to categorize what Solomon can do with that. So again, he is the most powerful man in the world at this time, okay? He has queens from other lands that come and hear him speak and literally praise him, praise his God, and write him a big fat check because he's that wise. That doesn't happen every day. So as you look at that, as a Jew, that is how they would read that. They would go, ah, God is saying something about what's happening in Solomon's heart during this season, okay? And it goes through all this other stuff. King Solomon made in verse 16, 200 shields of gold using 600 shekels of gold. Each was for his shield. He made 300 shields in verse 17 out of beaten gold using minas and all this other stuff. These were all things for the house of God. Moreover, the king made in verse 18 a great ivory throne and overlaid it with refined gold. So this is his seat that he would sit on. It's made of ivory, solid ivory, and then it's plated in gold. I mean, I remember in when I was, a freshman in college, right after trusted Christ, I went home to the church that I grew up in, the Christmas Easter church that I attended, and they were doing a giving campaign, right? And they were pricing out all the items in the church and what they were going to cost, okay? The price of the pulpit, okay? Just the pulpit that they were going to build in this suburban town in Dallas for the pastor to teach out of, I'll never forget this, was $6,000. I'm like, for a wooden box that Jokas can make, you know, and weld the legs together for probably $300, you're going to have a $6,000 pulpit? Do you really think that's the best use of God's resources? I'm like, hey, get a nice pulpit, right? Make it out of oak. It doesn't need to be made out of Doug fir or whatever. Like, make it nice. But really? And I start reading this stuff, and I'm like, Solomon, really? Did you need an ivory throne overlaid with pure gold? Like, Solomon, at some point, you've got to go, this is a little bit excessive, right? And he just doesn't put it all together. So his heart's still right there. He hasn't fallen yet, but boy, it's bad, okay? Look at verse 21. All of Solomon's drinking vessels were gold. All the vessels of the house of the forest of Lebanon were pure gold. None was silver. It was not considered valuable in the days of Solomon. He drank out of gold cups. His dog had dishes of gold. He had a golden throne, probably that one and the other one, okay? Everything was gold.
I know why, like, we associate 666 with like, evil, but why would the Jewish reader associate 666 with evil?
Numbers are big in their culture as well, and I think that one came from the Jews, you know, so as you look at 3, as you look at 7, as you look at 40, those are all numbers that are significant, 40 being a number of testing and purifying, 7 being one of completion, 3 as well, one of completion. So those numbers, for whatever reason, based on their reading of Scripture, that's part of their heritage and part of their how they see Scripture. So I think the other ones are probably a little bit more common as we read throughout, but this no doubt would have been one that they went, that's odd, why is that mentioned here? So, okay. So again, hyperinflation, everything that was to us would have been of extreme valuable in their day and age is not. Verse 22, the king had at sea at ships from Tarshish, which is where Jonah sailed from. They would go out and bring in stuff, ivory, apes, peacocks, I mean, gold, silver, all of it, right? They would come out and bring all these extravagant things to Solomon. 24, all the earth was seeking the presence of Solomon to hear the wisdom which God had put in his heart. What do you think that does to you when the entire world is seeking your wisdom and your counsel? You think? Man, it's hard to stay humble when you know you're the smartest guy in the world. not only the smartest guy in the world at the time, he's the smartest guy that's ever lived. Ever. Ever. At some point, you just can't sustain that. And you add women, you add money, you add power, you add prestige from people and the folks around you. Do you think Solomon has anyone in his life that's not a yes man that can say, hey, Solomon, by the way, you're an idiot. Man, I love you, but you're an idiot. Stop doing that. This is sin. Do you think at this point there's anybody that has the chutzpah to stand up to him and to say, man, Solomon, something's awry here. Something is off. If they're seeing those signs, he set up his kingdom that way, right, with advisors and governors and all these other people. But boy, I'd make the argument that would be pretty difficult to do in this season of his life.
So, like, if someone did make the argument, couldn't Solomon just say, like, well, this isn't coming from me, you know, this is a gift from God. He promised me honor and riches. So, like,
yeah. And again, that's not the issue, right? I think ultimately, so yes, I think that's true. I wonder if they're like Nathan, seeing cracks in David and seeing stuff that's underneath the surface, that's a result of the weight that's above the surface. So again, I mean, money in the New Testament, it's the root of all evil, right? It's not evil, but boy, it brings about something within all of us, right, that causes us to say, I'm going to serve God or I'm going to serve money. And Jesus says, man, you can't serve two masters. You'll serve either God or you'll serve money. And the same with Solomon. He's hitting some forks in the road that those around him, I think, could see. And again, it's not the fault of money. It's not the fault of God. It's not the fault of power. It's the fault of Solomon's heart and where he's investing underneath the waterline. Does that make sense? And apparently he's not. He's not building below the surface. He's building above the surface because that's what matters to Solomon. So, true. God is at the helm of this. He is the one that's doling out the blessing. It's Solomon's job to build character and to dig roots and to walk with God. And that's all God told him to do. And apparently, he's not doing it. And apparently, I don't know that he could anyway. So, it's a tough equation for sure. Okay? Let's keep going. Okay? 26, Solomon gathered chariots and horsemen. He had 1,400 chariots, 12,000 horsemen. He stationed them at the chariot cities and with the king of Jerusalem. So all the cities that he had fortified, Megiddo, Hazor in the north. There's one other one. That he made chariot cities as well as Jerusalem. He's got a ton of fortifications. 17 or 27, rather, you see it again. The king made silver as common as stones in Jerusalem. That's like saying the king made silver is abundant as dead grass in Fresno in July. It's everywhere. That's all there is, okay? There are nothing but stones in Jerusalem, okay? It is excessive and it is beyond, okay? So as you look at chapter 10, you're seeing hints of too much money, too much power, too many women that we saw a chapter back with 900 wives and concubines together. It's just excessive on every level. Now, chapter 11, verse 1, Solomon now has been king for 25 years-ish at this point, and now we're going to see what has happened kind of behind the scenes in his life, okay? So this is the downfall of Solomon. This is what causes or the cause of his downfall. So let's pick that up. 11 verse 1. Somebody pick up there.
But Solomon loved many foreign women, as well as the daughter of Pharaoh, women of the Moabites, Amorites, Edomites, Sidonians and Hittites.
All right, so stop there. What do you notice about that list? They're what?
He didn't discriminate.
No, he did discriminate. Okay, so fair enough. There's a half full view of it, okay? He wasn't discriminatory in his women, so he liked 31 flavors of the ice cream, and I just want chocolate. I want everyone, okay? So there's Solomon for you, okay? So he wanted to try them all, and he did. He did. What else do you notice about that? That is the first half-full view of that verse I've ever heard, by the way. So he's not racist. Okay, he's not. Fair enough. They're all pagan nations, which means they bring in what? Pagan gods, right? So the woman from Pharaoh, she brings in at least 10 gods that she worships, probably more. Moab, who do the Moabites worship? Molech or Chemosh, depending on where we're at in the territory. Ammonites, same thing. Edom, Sidonians, Hittites, these are all women that are tied to a different nation who grew up worshiping different gods and a different belief system. So you've got a pantheon of gods that are representative in Solomon's, just some of these women that are mentioned, okay? This is just a few of the nations that he would have married from, okay? From the nations concerning which the Lord said, verse 2, you shall not associate with them, neither shall they associate with you, for they will surely turn your heart away after their gods. Solomon held fast to these in love. Is God a racist? Does God not want Solomon to marry someone from a different nation because they have a different skin color or speak a different language? No. What is the reason? They will, what's the text say? Turn your heart away. So if we're going to take a gal like Ruth, who worships a foreign god, and even though she's a Moabite woman, if she converts and follows God, is she on the, is she okay to marry for an Israelite? Absolutely, right? So we've seen this before. God says the problem is not necessarily one woman or two women or what have you, okay? It's about idolatry, which is fascinating. I had probably the most mind-boggling conversation we ever had in seminary was around this idea of multiple wives. God's issue with multiple wives is never the wives. It's always what they bring, right? So we were talking in cross-cultural context when the gospel is going for the very first time and the Bible is being written into a culture that practices polygamy, right? And a man has multiple wives. Is the job of the American missionary to go blow up all those marriages and say, okay, which one was your first? Okay, you keep that one. All the rest of these you get rid of because God is against polygamy. Well, what happens if all those women happen to worship the same God, or they all convert? Like, is that God's heart? And boy, missionaries had to wrestle with that for a long time, because oftentimes they would go in this American idea of Christianity, they would go blow up a family, blow up all the extra wives that this guy had had married, and possibly wasn't because of the wrong reasons. He may have been supporting and loving and taking in, kind of like the whole Ruth and Boaz type picture of an additional wife to support and to love, and they had to wrestle with this. And you continue to look at Scripture. God never speaks against polygamy just for polygamy's sake. It's always because there are other things that come with polygamy, and those are the strings that you don't want. It's their hearts, it's their gods, it's everything else. And God knew that. So Solomon is walking down this road, okay? These are the unexpected consequences of what he's getting by having 900 wives and concubines.
Wait, but what conclusion did you come to?
I didn't.
You didn't?
I'm going to have one wife, okay? That's the conclusion I came to. Michelle likes that conclusion, by the way, very much. Yeah.
So these other wives, or these pagan wives, would, like, draw their hearts away, right? And that's different than, like, money drawing the heart away, so it's not inherent in the money, but it is inherent in the wife?
It's inherent in the wife because they bring other gods. So it's not necessarily the fault of the wife per se. It's the baggage that they bring. So yeah, it's because they worship foreign gods. And idolatry is at the heart of why God doesn't want foreign women. Idolatry is at the heart of why God doesn't want too much money, because you're going to worship money and not God. So, and Solomon, in a sense, is worshiping the women that he's married because he's realizing, oh my gosh, I have to appease my wife from Egypt, who wants a statue to Ra, the sun god. And then I need to appease my wife from Moab, who wants a statue of Chemosh, right? So these become more important. Managing my wives and keeping them out of catfights is becoming more important than the worship of my God. Does that make sense?
So do polygamous Christians actually have an argument?
In the States, I would say no. No. Overseas, prior to the coming of the gospel, sometimes polygamy is built into a culture to protect and to provide rightly for women in a godly way, if that makes sense. So there are reasons why that can be done outside of why Solomon is doing it. Solomon is doing it why?
Land,
money, power, okay? There are cultures that, hey, that woman is broken. She is viewed in our society because somebody raped her or something like that, is untouchable, no one's going to marry her, I'm going to bring her in, I'm going to redeem her, I'm going to raise her, I'm going to provide for her a male offspring so she has a legacy and a heritage, okay? So sometimes it can be done with those intentions. Again, I don't think that we have a case for that as Americans. I think, and American sounds weird, but I think God spoke into that, and I think you go back to Genesis, and God's plan was what? One man, one woman for life. That was clearly God's purpose. Now, are there exceptions to that rule that I think, for Sister Mike, who everything is black and white in this world, need to recognize? Yeah, probably. So, unless you're panicked, I'm going to have one woman for the rest of my life, Lord willing, unless she shoots me, which is possible because, you know, I'm teasing. But that's how I see Scripture, okay? So I don't see room for that. It's just that system doesn't work here. That's not that is not the way to redeem someone maybe that's in that system, okay? Where in other cultures it may be, so, okay? So here's the problem, okay? Verse 3, he had 700 wives, princesses, 300 concubines, and his wives did what? End of verse 3. Turned his heart away. This is the problem that God has, okay? The wives are going to do something in Solomon that's evil, and this is it, okay? Verse 4, keep reading.
For it was so, when Solomon was old, that his wives turned his heart after their gods, and his heart was not loyal to the Lord his God, and as was the heart of his father David.
All right, now there's a lot in this verse. So what happens ultimately, by the way, at the end of Solomon's life? Idolatry, okay? By the way, you see this repeated, gang. Walking with God for 5 years, for 10 years, for 20 years, that's easy, okay? Walk with God for 80 years, okay? That is my biggest fear, right? I became a Christian when I was 18. I'm 40. I've been walking with God longer than I was not walking with God. None of it matters. If I tank my marriage tomorrow, if I commit some sin that tarnishes my entire walk with God, none of what I've done up to this point matters a bit. You guys will all see me with an asterisk next to my name. Yeah, okay, I sat in residence here. Yeah, okay, Mike did that or whatever. And good that he started a nonprofit. None of that will matter. None of it, okay? Walking with God for a lifetime, that's what's difficult, and that's what our aspiration should be. This scares me to death because of the best men, the best women in the Bible, many of them fail, and they fail in the last 10% of their lives, at the very end. They have too much time, money, resources, excess, whatever it is, and that's when they blow it. So think about that as you think about your lives in context of the entire line and not just a dot on that line, okay? So his heart is turned away. For it came about when Solomon was old, his wife turned his heart away. We just read that. His heart was not wholly devoted. Again, and this is where I think the key of David's life is, okay? What do we not see ever, according to verse 4, in David's life? There's no idolatry. There's no worship of other gods ever. And I think that's what made God pleased with David, that he was a man after God's own heart. Okay? Now, verse 5, this is how bad it gets.
For Solomon went after Ashtaroth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and after Milcom, the abomination of the Amorites. Solomon did evil in the sight of the Lord and did not fully follow the Lord as did his father David.
Verse 5, Solomon went after, pursued with vigor these other pagan gods, okay? Verse 7 and 8, this will blow your mind.
Then Solomon built a high place for Chemosh, the abomination of Moab, on the hill that is east of Jerusalem.
All right, stop there. Who's Chemosh?
Child
sacrifice god. Solomon built an idol for Moab. Where? On the mountain, which is east of Jerusalem, okay? What is the mountain east of Jerusalem? The Mount of Olives. Solomon builds an idol factory or an idol center to worship Chemosh across the hill. And we're not talking like, we're talking a quarter of a mile away sat the temple. And just through the Kidron Valley up and over to the Mount of Olives is now a idol worshiping place where they would sacrifice live children on an altar to a foreign god because Solomon thought marrying a bunch of women to form alliances was a really good idea 20 years ago. And now all of a sudden, what's below the surface can't sustain what's above the surface. And for Molech, verse 7, the detestable idol of the sons of Moab, okay, both of those god, both of those gods he builds idols to. Verse 8, thus also he did for all his foreign wives who burn incense and sacrifice to their gods. So what has Solomon had to do because of the wives that he's had? Every woman gets a sack, or whatever god that they worship, he's got an idol for them to worship wherever, right outside of Jerusalem. Maybe in the temple even. Or in that area, we don't know, okay? So here is my contention with Solomon. It's not the stuff that caused him the ultimate downfall. It's Solomon's heart, and God knew that. These women will turn your heart away from me, okay? Because of the gods they worship. The women are not the problem. They're not evil. The gods that they worship are. And when you bring that into your home and you try to raise a little baby lion for a little bit, it's really cute and cuddly at the beginning, and so all of a sudden you keep feeding it, and it grows, and all of a sudden what was cute and cuddly has now outgrown you. It's more powerful than you, and you can't contain it anymore, and it's going to eat you alive. And that's exactly what happened with Solomon. All these things, all these great little pet projects that he had, seemed brilliant at the time, and he got land, and he got money, and he got power, and he got to sleep with 1,000 women, okay? But at the end of his life, it destroyed him. It ate him from the inside out, and this is the result of it. And what happens here is not a fall. Solomon did not fall. David did not fall. Nobody in Scripture falls. They make daily, incremental, compromising decisions that over time equate to rotting in their life, okay? Anybody come in south on the street right over here? Did you guys notice what was laying in the middle of the road?
A tree.
That tree didn't fall today. It fell years ago, okay? It rotted from the inside out. It hasn't gotten enough water for at least 5 years, and you're just seeing the end result of it. Now, one day, there's a big catastrophe, and there's a tree in the middle of the street. That didn't happen today. That happened over years of neglect, years of poor decision-making, that tree couldn't, you know, make a decision anyway, but you get the idea, right? That didn't happen because someone forgot to water the tree yesterday. That happened because that tree hasn't been taken care of in a decade, okay? That's Solomon.
Potentially a silly question. What's the difference between a wife and a concubine?
Practically speaking, I don't know. To be frank, Solomon would have slept with all of them. Wives, I think, were more endearing, maybe more significant. They had more rights. Solomon would have treated them better, and that maybe he didn't. He talks about loving them. You know, there would have been a higher value placed on them. Concubines were not slaves, but servants. They were there to serve you, not to cherish and love as much as you can do that with multiple wives. Okay, so that's kind of the distinction. Oftentimes they're figureheads, they're symbolic of power and those sorts of things. So that's the idea. Okay, so again, that's my contention with Solomon. It's not the money, it's not the women, it's where those things ultimately lead, and Solomon just could not sustain it. And I don't know who frankly could. Stephen, does that help kind of wrestle that beast to the ground in terms of that question that you asked?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. It's easy to point the finger at God, I think, in the midst of this, and it's a fair question, okay? So just to be clear on that, but it's Solomon's heart that he quit investing below the waterline, which is, it's scary, okay? Now, verse 9, God's response.
So the Lord became angry with Solomon because his heart had turned away from the Lord God of Israel, who had appeared to him twice, and he had commanded him concerning this thing, that he should not go after other gods.
Okay, so if you were to say, what is God mad about? What is God mad about? Give me one word.
Idolatry.
Idolatry is what causes the split in the kingdom, okay? And again, because Solomon can't sustain it, it's not the women, it's not the money, it's not the too many horses, but they all lead to one thing, which is worshiping the wrong thing and not me. God is mad about idolatry, okay? So the Lord said, verse 11, because you've done this and you have not kept the covenant of my statutes, which I commanded you, I will surely tear the kingdom from you and I will give it to your servant. This is just like Saul. When Samuel says, hey, you didn't walk with me, and as a result of this, I'm tearing the kingdom from your hand, and I'm going to give it to a king that I have chosen. His name is David. God says the same thing. I'm going to tear the kingdom. Part of it's going to go to your servant, by the way, who's Jeroboam, and part of it's going to go to your son. Okay. Nevertheless, verse 12, I will not do it in your days for the sake of your father David, but I will tear it out of the hand of your son. However, I will not tear away all the kingdom. I will give one tribe to your son for the sake of my servant David and for the sake of Jerusalem, which I have chosen. Okay, that is Judah. And by association, Benjamin is in there as well. Okay, so the one tribe that Solomon's line gets to hang on to is Judah, where the kings come from. The other 10 are going to go to the north with Jeroboam and the kings that follow up there. Okay, make sense? So this is it. This is 931 BC. It's game over. We're 40 years of Solomon's reign is at this point close to being done, and he is about to die. Okay, Solomon gets a warning now in verses 14 and following about what's to come. God raises up basically three adversaries. So Solomon's heyday, his Camelot is over. Okay, and from this point forward, God is now raising up adversaries for him that are going to become an issue. Okay. The first two, they're not as important. They're verse 14, the Lord raised up an adversary to Solomon, Hadad the Edomite. He was of the royal line of Edom. Verse 17, this guy ends up fleeing to Egypt from Solomon and comes back later. He found in verse 19 great favor before Pharaoh. He gave him in marriage the sister of his own wife. So he's basically a guy that God is raising up from the Edomites that's beginning to get favor with Egypt, who's a big deal right now, is gaining a wife and power, and ultimately is going to be an issue to Solomon. Not super important, okay, but one of the three adversaries that God raises up. The second one in verse 23 is named Rezon, okay, again, a guy that's an adversary to him. And then in verse 26, this is the one that's going to become an issue to Solomon. Somebody pick up there in verse 26.
Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, and Ephraim of Zeredah, a servant of Solomon, whose mother's name was Zeruah, a widow, also lifted up his hand against the king.
Okay, this is the same Jeroboam that we see is going to be the next king in Israel. The first king underneath the split kingdom is Jeroboam, the son of Nebat. Okay, and we're going to see why he rebelled.
And this was the reason why he lifted up his hand against the king. Solomon built the Milo and closed up the breach of the city of David, his father. The man Jeroboam was very able, and when Solomon saw that the young man was industrious, he gave him charge over all the forced labor of the house of Joseph. All
right, so what is Jeroboam's job within Solomon's kingdom?
Slave master.
Over who? House of Joseph. This isn't the house of Egypt. This isn't the house of Aram. These are servants that Solomon is now putting to task. And he's put Jeroboam. Now, if you are the slave master, slave is a bad word, servant master, indentured servant master, what type of personality would you guess this guy has? He's probably not real warm and fuzzy, not cuddly, right? He's a taskmaster. He's what you envision in the movies where the Egyptians are building pyramid. This is that guy, okay? He's a hard-hearted, effective guy. He's good at his job, okay? As a result, there's a guy that comes to him in verse 29, Ahijah the prophet. And he comes to Jeroboam, and he says in verse 31, take for yourself 10 pieces, for thus the Lord says, the God of Israel, behold, I will tear the kingdom out of the hand of Solomon and give you 10 tribes. So he uses this illustration to say, Jeroboam, God is judging Solomon. You're going to get 10 of these torn pieces from God's hand, okay? However, verse 34, nevertheless, I will not take the whole kingdom out of his hand. I will make him ruler all the days of his life for the sake of my servant David, whom I chose, who observed my commandments and statutes, but I will take the kingdom from his son's hand and give it to you, even the 10 tribes. So this isn't going to happen again, just like God said during Solomon's day, when Rehoboam comes on the throne, then the kingdom's going to split. Jeroboam is going to get 10 of the pieces, but verse 36, to his son, I will give one tribe, my servant David, because my servant David has held up a lamp before me in Jerusalem, the city which where I have chosen myself and to put my name. Okay, so Rehoboam's going to get one, as you guys know, two ultimate tribes. Okay, so that's the idea. So God is prophesied through a prophet to Jeroboam, who is Solomon's, again, kind of taskmaster. You're going to get 10 of the 12 tribes. Okay, Solomon, because he's obedient and has a soft heart, in verse 40, watch what he does.
Solomon sought therefore to kill Jeroboam, but Jeroboam arose and fled into Egypt to Shishak, king of Egypt, and was in Egypt until the death of Solomon.
So Solomon, instead of obeying and just taking his lumps and maybe praying, says, look, I'll just kill the guy and that'll end the prophecy. Okay, doesn't get that. Jeroboam flees now to Egypt, verses 41 through 43. Solomon dies. Okay. Verse 43, Solomon slept with his fathers, was buried in the city of his father David, and his son Rehoboam reigned in his place. Okay, so 931 BC, game over. Rehoboam is now the king, and he's currently ruling all of Israel and Judah, and it's about to split underneath him. Okay, Rehoboam, we're going to find a lot about this guy and who he is and what type of son Solomon has raised. Okay, this is another great illustration. Okay, what Solomon could kind of handle, his son cannot. Okay? Yes, Stephen.
So when was Ecclesiastes written? Because that was written basically.
Ecclesiastes is at the end of Solomon's life. Yeah. Song of Solomon, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes. I think it's in that order. So that's one of the last books that Solomon writes. So Solomon has the wits about him to recognize, man, all the stuff I pursued in vigor, it's useless. So there's probably a sense of repentance in him, but man, the handwriting's on the wall at this point. God has said what God has said. So he recognizes this, but he can't do anything about it.
What's the significance of Jeroboam and Rehoboam, the end of their names being the same? Is there any...
It's a great question. I mean, they mean something. I can't remember the meaning of either of their names, what Boam means or what have you. I'm not sure. Anybody got a note on the meaning of any of those guys' names? They may not be significant. Anyway. All right. So Rehoboam, okay, this young kid, okay, goes to Shechem, which is the place of power in the northern 10 tribes at this point, and he's going to go make himself king, okay? Verse 2, it came about when Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, heard it, that he was living in Egypt and finds out that Solomon's dead, he returns. They sent and called him in verse 3, and Jeroboam and all the assembly of Israel came and spoke to Rehoboam. Okay, Jeroboam, Solomon's, you know, fleed servant, now comes back, and they're speaking to Rehoboam. So this is the request they make of Rehoboam, verse 4.
Your father made our yoke heavy. Now therefore, lighten the hard service of your father and his heavy yoke on us, and we will serve you.
Now, notice who's saying this again in verse 3. Jeroboam. What was Jeroboam's job?
Slave master.
And he says about Solomon, he made our lives difficult. In fact, too difficult. So what type of king was Solomon at the end of his reign? Or through years of it?
Hard.
I mean, he was a hard man. He wanted stuff built. He wanted, you know, so he put his people to work. And his people didn't necessarily like that. Now, they had abundance. They had golden cups to drink out of, but man, it came at a great price. And Jeroboam says, hey, your daddy, he made it really hard around here, okay? Would you please lighten our load? Would you back it off a notch and make life a little bit better around here? By the way, you've got all the gold, all the stuff that you want. Daddy's left that for you in his will. Like, you have everything you could possibly need, okay? Now, Rehoboam may be, I think as Brad calls him, the dumbest guy in your Bible, okay? He is probably one of the most prideful. He's just an idiot, okay? Good old-fashioned idiot. Verse 5.
He said to them, go away for 3 days, then come again to me.
Why is he doing that? Let me think about it, okay? Is that good? Absolutely, okay? What else does he do? Yeah, who are the elders? The guys that did what, according to verse 6?
His father's counsel.
Okay. So if you're 21, 22 years old, who are you seeking the advice of? Older, wise guys, right? That's brilliant. Hey, you guys have been around the block. You've seen this before, right? I was sucking my thumb when daddy was, you know, king. Like, what do y'all think? You've been serving him for 40 years. What do you say? This is what they said. Okay, verse 7. And he asked him in verse 6, "How do you counsel me? What do you want me to do?" Verse 7.
And they said to him, "If you will be a servant to this people today and serve them and speak good words to them when you answer them, then they will be your servants forever."
Okay? Tell me about that advice. What are they saying?
If you heed what they say, they'll
listen to your people and be a what?
Servant.
A servant. That is the job of a king. That is what your grandfather David did. He was a shepherd and he served the people. Solomon whipped the people, put them under hard labor, and they didn't like him. Okay? Is that good advice? It's fantastic advice, is what that is. Okay? But, verse 8, he forsook the counsel, of the elders, which they had given him, and consulted with the young men who grew up with him and served him. So now who does he talk to? His buddies. His young, arrogant, testosterone-filled buddies. And this is the counsel that they give him. Verse 9.
And he said to them, "What advice do you have to give? How should I answer the people who have spoken to me, saying, 'Lighten the yoke that your father put on us'?" And the young men said, then the young men who had grown up with him spoke, saying, "Thus you should speak to this people who have spoken to you, saying, 'Your father made your yoke heavy, but I, but you make it lighter on us.'"
All right, stop right there. So what is their counsel? What are they saying about Solomon? And ultimately the counsel that they're giving Rehoboam, as opposed to the counsel that he just got from the older wise men.
We haven't gotten to it yet.
Dude, it's in one way it's coming. Okay, I'm saving that. This last little, it's so good. Should be a guy's only day, but it isn't, so we're just going to have to deal with it. Let's just read it at this point. So this is their counsel. This is what you're going to tell the people, okay? Max, go ahead and read that. Halfway through verse 10.
"Thus shall you say to them, 'My little finger is thicker than my father's thighs.'"
Keep going.
"Now, whereas my father laid on you a heavy yoke, I will add to your yoke. My father's disciplined you with whips, but I will discipline you with scorpions."
Okay, so they say, these young men basically say, "Hey, you thought it was harder than Solomon? Wait till you see me. You ain't seen nothing yet." And they placate his pride, right? What's the conundrum as Rehoboam? Why do you not want to serve or be humble in terms of the advice that was given to the elders? What is the downside of that? How are they going to view you as a king? Weak. So is this young, 20-something? What is he going to do? "I'm going to show my power. I'm going to beat my chest." And he says, "My little finger is thicker than my father's." It's not thigh. You guys remember the covenant that Abraham made with Eliezer? It's about going back to the promised land to get a wife. And he said, "You swear to me by my organ that procreates." That's what he's saying. "My little finger is thicker than my..." Okay, that's what he's saying. This is a male pride contest, okay? If you think my dad was a big deal, you ain't seen nothing yet. He disciplined you with whips. I'm going to discipline you with scorpions. If you thought your life was hard then, you just wait. And this is where Rehoboam blows it. He gets great counsel from the wise men that say, "Be a servant, the people will follow you." And he says, no. "Young guys, what do you say? Exercise your pride, beat your chest, make a name for yourself." And he says, "Yeah, that's what I want to do." So, Jeroboam, verse 12, "And all the people came to Rehoboam, returned to me on the third day. The king answered," verse 13, "the people harshly. He forsook the advice of the elders which they had given him. And he says to them exactly what they said. 'My father made your yoke heavy,' verse 14, 'but I will add to your yoke. My father disciplined you with whips. I will discipline with you with scorpions.' So the king did not listen in verse 15 to the advice, for it was a turn of events from the Lord, which he might establish his word, which the Lord had spoken through Ahijah, the prophet that came to Jeroboam and said, 'This is what's going to happen. 10 tribes are going to you. 2 are going to go to Rehoboam. This is from the Lord.'" So this prideful, arrogant young man has the opportunity before him to make the right choice and blows it, okay? He can't handle, this is a spoiled child that has no idea what his father has done, what he has earned, and he's left with all this inheritance, and now he wants to make a name for himself, and he can't handle it. Okay? How do you think the people are going to respond when Rehoboam ramps up the pain, ramps up the hurt, ramps up the building, ramps up all the difficulty in their life? Revolution. They're going to rebel. And who are they going to go with? Jeroboam, who says, hey, why don't you guys come follow me? I'll actually make your life easier. Okay? So, all of Israel, verse 16, saw that the king did not listen to them. The king answered. They answered the king and said, what portion do we have in David, i.e. Judah? We have no inheritance in Jesse. To your tents, O Israel. Now look after your own house, David. What are the people saying? Dude, you're from the south. What do we have to do with you? We're going to stay up north. The heck with you. We're going to find our own king. Manage your own houses, Judah. That's fine, but we're not going to follow you. So this is what causes the split. But as for the sons of Israel who lived in the cities of Judah, Rehoboam reigned over them. So he gets, again, the two tribes down south, and now the other tribes go north. Now, this may be one of the other dumbest things that Rehoboam ever does. Read 18.
Then King Rehoboam sent Adoram, who was in charge of the revenue, but all Israel stoned him with stones and he died.
Okay, so Rehoboam sends somebody up north, basically as a representative of him, to go speak to the people that just rebelled, okay? Anybody remember who Adoram was? We mentioned him in David's life. My Bible has a different version of his job description. He was over the forced labor. This is the other taskmaster that was the taskmaster underneath David. Rehoboam sends this guy to go negotiate a peace treaty. How do you think the people feel about this guy coming in to make a peace treaty with them? Dude, you've been whipping us and my family since David's day, right? So what do? They stone him. I mean, Rehoboam's dumb. I mean, how about send somebody else that the people actually would like, right? So he's an idiot. Israel's been in rebellion to the house of David to this day, so it splits here. Came about that all Israel heard that Rehoboam had returned. They sent and called him in assembly and made him king over all of Israel. None but the tribe of Judah followed the house of David. So Jeroboam now takes the north. They follow him. Rehoboam gets the south. 21, watch this.
And then Rehoboam came to Jerusalem and assembled all the house of Judah with the tribe of Benjamin, 180,000 chosen men who were warriors to fight against the house of Israel and the mighty, that he might restore the kingdom to Rehoboam, the son of Solomon.
All right, so we're about to have a civil war, okay? And we're going to muster troops. We're getting ready for battle. But God says, hey, that's not what I said would happen. Rehoboam, I'm tearing it from your hand. He brings in a prophet in verse 22. In verse 23, the prophet says to Rehoboam, verse 24, you must not go up against your relatives, the sons of Israel. Return every man to his house, for this thing has come from me. This is my desire. So they listened to the word of the Lord. They returned and went their way according to the word of the Lord. So Rehoboam is not allowed to even go to battle against Jeroboam because God said, this is what's going to happen. I gave you an opportunity. You chose stupid. You chose to listen to the young men and not the old men. You ramped up the pain and the difficulty, and as a result, you have caused the rebellion of the people, and you're not going to go fight against your brothers to make them follow you. Okay, so that's the idea. So kingdom now is split underneath Solomon, Rehoboam, and Jeroboam are the first two kings of their respective kingdoms, and we're going to see the fallout from there. All right, we are going to stop there today because I got to go to the airport. And we will pick up next week, so you guys again have the day off tomorrow, and we'll walk through the rest of this chart and the divided kingdom, the divided monarchy within Israel. All right? So you guys have a great day. We will see you at ODARK 30 in a week.